This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome, listeners, to the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, February 2, 2026. I'm Mark Stengel from Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Today's first article is a Christian Science perspective from Cheryl Hoffman. It's entitled, Knowing God Matters. Why bother with getting to know the divine? To me, Jesus provides the answer. One of the first things he preached implies that a lift of perspective is key to experiencing God's harmonious kingdom. The time has come and God's kingdom is near. Change the way you think and act and believe the good news. After this, Jesus started healing people without medicinal solutions. He often said that faith, a quality of consciousness, made them whole. Perspective matters, but Jesus showed us that knowing God isn't reliant on the workings of human minds. A Jewish religious leader, Nicodemus, came to Jesus saying that he must have been sent by God, giving the healings he had accomplished. Jesus responded that we're only able to see God's kingdom when we're born from above. To clarify, Jesus said, I can guarantee this truth. No one can enter God's kingdom without being born of water and the Spirit. Flesh and blood give birth to flesh and blood, but the Spirit gives birth to things that are spiritual. Jesus is pointing out that we feel and experience the harmony of God's kingdom when we yield to Spirit's view, which is spiritual, good, and true. If we accept that Spirit and not matter as our source, that changes everything. So when a problem comes up, we shouldn't lean on matter-based thinking, where problems seem to come from, but on Spirit, the infinite creator in which life truly is and only harmony exists. Mary Baker Eddy, who loved the Bible, discovered Christian Science when she dug into the Scriptures, especially Jesus' life and words, following a healing she experienced in 1866. For 3 years, she read little else, and after several more years of proving what she was finding, she published Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures to share her discovery. Her book still brings out how we can follow Jesus' example and demonstrate harmony and health for ourselves and our neighbors. She wrote at the very beginning that to those leaning on the sustaining infinite, today is big with blessings. We can lean on the sustaining infinite to meet our needs. Some time ago, my husband and I were driving through a snowstorm with a car full of family, including a young child. When my husband turned off a highway, the car did not make the turn, and we landed in a snowbank. Turning to God, I reminded myself that good solutions are always available. Barely before my husband could get out of the car, a truck stopped, and two young men got out. Within minutes, the three of them pushed the car out of the snowbank, and we were on our way. Leaning on the sustaining infinite means that as we recognize that God, divine good, is the real, and that we live in Spirit, always, we find solutions at hand. We can let love lead. We can release fear of danger. As we move forward, we can trust that the cycles of divine light will brighten the way and that we are cared for every moment. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, February 2, 2026, comes from the editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Krista Case Bryant. Her article is entitled, An Olympic Spirit of Discipline and Love. My Olympic dreams were forged first in the glow of our little black and white TV, and then in the crucible of a training regimen honed by a man from Siberia. My dad shipped me out to Duluth, Minnesota as a teenager to meet Nikolai Anikin, who would become my coach for the next 5 years as I made a bid for the 2002 Games. He was born in Ishim, halfway between Ukraine and Mongolia, where he attended Railway School 13. From those humble beginnings, he went on to ski in the 1956 Games, 4x10-kilometer relay in Cortina d'Ampezzo, Italy, bringing home gold for the Soviet Union in its debut on the Winter Olympic stage. As the torch is about to be lit in Italy again, Nikolai shines in my memory as the epitome of the Olympic spirit. He pushed us to bound up alpine ski slopes in summer, run for 4+ hours in the wheat woods, and do special Russian exercise, for instance, the wheelbarrow at early morning practices. He loved to tell us about his breakout year. My friends, they go to the dance. They go in the movies. But I'm practice in the stadium. And next year, I have 1.5 minute advantage, 10 kilometer race. I heard this in other skiing tales many times, but it was the stories I heard after he died in 2009 that gave me a deeper appreciation of the spirit that both impelled and transcended his achievements. The monitor's fixer and translator in Moscow, Olga Podolskaya, generously helped me by collecting reminiscences from his former athletes. All my merits are his merits, says Vladimir Voronkov, a 1972 Olympic gold medalist. I am grateful to destiny for my acquaintances with such a fine person. Intelligent, soft, sociable, he, without raising his voice, could convince anybody with his arguments. We heard about Nikolai's delight in the forest. Only a deer goes in this place. His friendliness when he started coaching in America on a ski team exchange before the Iron Curtain came down. His forgiveness when someone crushed his most prized asset, a Jeep Cherokee. But it's what Vladislav Vedinin, one of his athletes, said that means the most to me now as an editor. He was a very human person, but a rigid, exigent coach. Even as I apply that Nikolai-inspired sense of discipline and rigor to our journalism, I am reminded of his example of wonder, friendship, and forgiveness. He is proof that exigence and love are not contradictory, but complementary. And so, even as we are about to watch new gold medalists be crowned, I have to agree with another friend of this unassuming coach. Nikolai is one of the few truly great men I know. That an Olympic standard we can all aspire to, whether or not we start each morning by doing special Russian exercise. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, February 2, 2026, comes from Ukraine. It's entitled, Their Power Grid Under Attack, Ukrainians Face a Long, Cold Winter. And this article is written by special correspondent to the Christian Science Monitor, Dominique Sogol. Kyiv has felt the impact of Russian attacks against energy infrastructure extra hard this winter. A massive Russian bombardment last month hit three of the Ukrainian capital's 5 combined heat and power facilities, causing outages in half the households in the city. A second attack on a thermal power plant further disrupted energy flows from western Ukraine to the rest of the country. This is the most difficult winter we've had in the war, says Svetlana Tarasenko, bundled up in a puffy jacket as her phone charges at an emergency relief center near her apartment in Kyiv. The situation has sparked finger-pointing over failure to prepare and has left everyone struggling to stay warm. Russia's choice of targets points to a concerted effort to leave major cities, particularly Kyiv, disconnected from the national energy grid. Generators large and small are insufficient to close the gap. The situation is dire enough that President Volodymyr Zelensky in January declared a state of emergency in the energy sector. He singled out authorities in Kyiv for failing to do more to prepare. Simultaneously, the energy ministry has a new head after the cabinet was reshuffled in the wake of a corruption scandal. Ukrainians are rising to the challenge by banding together and drawing on well-honed emergency workflows in the country's fourth full winter in wartime conditions. Ms. Tarasenko was among those seeking support at an invincibility point in an orange tent. A common sight in frontline regions, these pop-up relief centers allow people to charge their phones, get a cup of hot tea or coffee, even a warm meal in an emergency. But such solutions are not enough. Experts say the crisis in Kyiv has been amplified by the cumulative effect of ever larger Russian attacks that penetrate air defense systems and the impact of abnormally cold weather. We knew that Russian attacks would come when it's this cold, but we're not ready for this, says Red Cross volunteer Michael Demenink. You just don't know when the weather will be this cold. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, February 2, 2026, comes from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's entitled, In Minneapolis and Beyond, Businesses Ban ICE Officers. And this article is written by staff writers for the Christian Science Monitor, Sarah Matusik and Victoria Hoffman. Last month, the Department of Homeland Security planned to send 2,000 federal agents to the Minneapolis area. By the end of January, hundreds more were on the way, says Secretary Kristi Noem. The Trump administration says the show of force is necessary to accomplish its goal of arresting unauthorized immigrant criminals, cracking down on fraud, and protecting agents from activists impeding their work. The federal agents' conduct, including the firing of tear gas, breaking of car windows, and a pair of recent shootings, has prompted strong public opposition. Signs seeking to deny access to immigration and customs enforcement have cropped up on storefront windows and doors. Some signs ask for warrants signed by a judge, not just by ICE officials. Lawyers say those signs could carry limited legal weight. But, symbolically at least, that resistance appears to match growing support for immigrants nationally, as well as dissatisfaction with the Trump administration's crackdown, as shown in polls. In January, an ICE officer fatally shot Renee Good in her car, sparking anti-ICE protests here and nationwide. The federal week, a federal officer shot another person during an attempted apprehension. The government claims the officers acted defensively both times. Generally, federal immigration law enforcement needs a warrant signed by a federal judge to enter private businesses while searching for unauthorized immigrants. That's because the Fourth Amendment requires the government to show probable cause to protect people from unreasonable searches and seizures. Storefront signs demanding these judicial warrants emphasize this legal standard. It's not that the absence of a sign somehow gives ICE some authority to enter. The sign's not necessary, says Lucas Gutenberg, a Stanford Law School professor and former Homeland Security official. An employer could, in theory, give consent to allow law enforcement to enter, he says. But the posted notice makes clear that the employer does not consent. ICE officers sometimes obtain those administrative warrants to arrest and detain people for immigration violations. However, administrative warrants aren't signed by a judge. The agency issues them. The government generally can't enter homes or other private spaces on an administrative warrant alone unless the officer obtains consent. Yet what constitutes private space isn't always straightforward, says attorney Dan Givadin, who specializes in criminal and immigration law in Allen, Texas. Think of parts of buildings where anyone can walk in from the street and pass through, he says. The cornerstone of the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is reasonableness and expectations of privacy, says Mr. Givadin, a former prosecutor for ICE and the Justice Department. There's definitely an insanely reduced amount of privacy expectation in that public atrium. Your Christian Science Monitor news continues for Monday, February 2, 2026, with this article from China. It is written by the staff of the Christian Science Monitor. China's population dropped again, despite incentives. A campaign to encourage women to have more children has so far failed to arrest China's sharply declining population. Its population fell by 3.4 million at the end of 2025 to 1.4 billion, the National Bureau of Statistics reported last month. Birth rates are declining around the world, with China's repeatedly the lowest since the 1940s. Beijing removed the one-child policy in 2016 and has since tried cash subsidies and other incentives for couples. With birth rates falling on every continent, there are growing questions about how humanity can and should respond. In the long run, if humanity's average birth rate goes and stays below 2, then the size of the human population will decrease, says Dean Spears, associate professor of economics at the University of Texas. There is no reason to be confident the trend is likely to reverse course soon or automatically. Almost everywhere, parents are choosing to have fewer children, whether for economic or personal reasons. Two-thirds of the planet's population now lives in a region where the fertility rate has fallen below the replacement level. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, February 2, 2026, comes from Kyrgyzstan. Their glaciers shrinking, Central Asian nations share water wealth. And this article is written by staff writer for our contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, Alexander Thompson. You can hear and feel the Adigenine Glacier melting. Every step to the inch and a half layer of snow reveals trickles running over the ice's surface. Turquoise water roars as it plunges through deep, jagged channels down the slope. Bakit Ermabayev crouches down and holds a measuring tape to the small PVC pipe sticking up from the Adigene's ice. 36 centimeters, Mr. Ermabayev reads out as his colleague Gulbara Omarova notes it down. The pair of glaciologists affiliated with the Kyrgyz Institute of Water Problems and Hydropower have drilled the pipe about 15 feet into the glacier at the beginning of the month, and in just 20 days, those 36 centimeters or 14 inches have melted. It means the surface of the glacier has dropped 13 and a half feet since last year, Ms. Omarova calculates, which is fast. If the Adigenine Glacier were healthy, you'd expect about 3 to 6 feet of melt each year, she says. 50 years since the Soviet diverted the water of Central Asia's great rivers to water cotton fields and doomed the Aral Sea, Central Asian states face a new and perhaps greater ecological threat. As climate change warms the region at double the global rate, the mountains, snow, and glaciers' ice that feed those rivers are disappearing. For two decades, management of the region's mighty rivers, 30,000 miles of canals and 80 major reservoirs, which zigzag across Central Asia's scramble of borders, was a source of tensions and distrust. Yet, in the last few years, Central Asian leaders have turned the page on two decades of bickering over their shared water resources as the climate threat looms. The region's five states have signed historic border treaties, agreed to joint control of major water projects, and brought a more level-headed approach to negotiations over who gets water, how much, and when. This is now the turning point to something much better, says Volker Frobarth, the Organization for Security and Cooperation and Europe's ambassador to Kyrgyzstan. There's one thing clear. They have understood that they need to cooperate. Change began in 2016 when a new president, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, came to power in Uzbekistan, and he immediately took a more constructive tone on water, starting to work with Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan on their hydropower projects, rather than oppose them. A breakthrough came in the summer of 2024, Ambassador Frobarth says. Upstream Kyrgyzstan and downstream Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan agreed to equally share financing and planning of the massive Kambarada 1 hydroelectric project, even though it was located entirely in Kyrgyzstan. Since then, the border agreements between Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan have settled long-standing disputes over water, and the five countries' leaders now regularly meet with water at the top of the agenda. But 2025 proved a test of the new spirit of collaboration. Last year was the driest in decades, as there was little rain for 8 months, says Danira Zigashina, the director of the Interstate Commission for Water Coordination's Scientific Information Service. In tough negotiations this past summer, Uzbekistan agreed to release more water to save the harvest downstream in Kazakhstan, she says. In winter, with little water left in mountain reservoirs, Kazakhstan promised additional electricity exports to Kyrgyzstan to keep the lights on. Thanks to cooperation, the countries were able to get through this year, Ms. Zagashina says. The challenges will come in the future. Next in your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, February 2, 2026, is an article from Canada, and it's written by the staff of the Christian Science Monitor. Canada and China are forging a new strategic partnership. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney announced January 16 an initial trade deal under which Canada will lower tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles from 100% to 6.1%. In exchange, Mr. Carney said he expects China to lower tariffs on Canadian canola seed, among other products. Mr. Carney is the first Canadian Prime Minister to have visited China in 9 years, amid tensions between the two countries. Canada is looking to strengthen their relationship amid greater tensions with the United States. China has emerged as the world's biggest EV market, accounting for about 60% of global sales in 2023, compared with 25% in Europe and 10% in the United States, according to the International Energy Agency. Last year, Chinese consumers bought more than 11 million EVs. The country's exports of EVs also increased 87% this past November over exports the year prior. Trump administration officials have said that Canada will regret the decision to allow for the import of some 49,000 Chinese EVs. It says the cars will not be allowed into the United States. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, February 2, 2026, is entitled, Powell Pushes Back on Fed Probe as Trump Denies Intimidation Charge. And this article is written by staff writers for the Christian Science Monitor, Lauren Belsey and Henry Gass. A year-long tug-of-war over interest rate policy between the White House and the Federal Reserve has broken out into the open, with political and economic implications that are just beginning to play out. Last month, Fed Chair Jerome Powell posted a video on social media saying that the Justice Department had threatened criminal charges over statements he made to Congress about office renovation costs as a pretext to pressure him to lower interest rates. There's nothing like this in recent Fed history, says Michael Bordo, an economic historian emeritus at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Presidents have in some way or other tried to push the Fed to lower rates, but none were as obvious and direct and threatening as this president, where the administration used the legal system to go after somebody. In his statement, Mr. Powell highlighted a principle widely supported in business, market, and even political circles. Independent central banks make better decisions than politically dominated ones. Economically, the record strongly supports this idea. When central bankers set rates, inflation tends to stay in check and economies prosper. When political leaders are in charge, inflation tends to rise. That's because political leaders want rates low as a way to buoy business. The business cycle does not align with the political cycle, says Aaron Klein, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. Sometimes the Fed has to enact short-term stressors, such as raising interest rates, to fend off inflation. By doing so, it enhances the chances of a stabler and stronger economy long-term, he adds. President Trump has said he didn't know anything about the investigation. Mr. Powell says the Justice Department is investigating allegations that he lied to Congress about the cost of renovations to Federal Reserve offices in Washington during a June hearing before the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. Responding to reports that the renovation includes ornate features such as special elevators, water features, and a rooftop garden, Mr. Powell said that some of those claims are just flatly misleading. Some of those are no longer in the plans, he added. The plans have continued to evolve. Cost overruns for federal infrastructure projects are typically investigated by Congress alone. When the Justice Department can get involved is if during that investigation a potential criminal offense is uncovered. That is what happened here when in July, Representative Ana Paulina Luna, a Florida Republican and a staunch Trump ally, asked the Justice Department to investigate Mr. Powell for potential perjury and making false statements to officials. Official project documents contradict Mr. Powell's congressional testimony, she claims. Such prosecutions are rare, however. False statement cases can be easy to charge, but very difficult to prove, says Paul Butler, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a former federal prosecutor in Washington. Winning such a case requires that a jury find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that a defendant lied knowingly and willfully and with an intent to deceive. The United States Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, which is handling the investigation, says it does not comment on ongoing investigations. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, February 2, 2026, is entitled, How the Race for Rare Earths Could Shape Myanmar's Civil War. And this article is written by a contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, Akash Hassan. Myanmar's civil war continues as the country resumes voting in what critics describe as sham elections designed to legitimize military rule. An estimated 3.5 million people have been displaced since the military overthrew the elected government in a 2021 coup, and across the countryside, rebel groups armed with drones, rocket launchers, and improvised explosives are fighting to hold the line. But analysts say there's more to the story than arms, territory, and questionable elections. The future of this conflict will be shaped by another factor lying just under the surface: rare earth minerals. Myanmar is a globally critical source of heavy rare earth elements, almost all of which flows into China for processing, says Richard Horsey, Myanmar advisor to the International Crisis Group. The deposits lie mostly in rebels' rural strongholds, bringing revenue and political leverage to groups fighting against the military junta. As international competition over these minerals grow, Myanmar's rare earth boom could bring investment that nudges the country towards stability, or it could prolong a war already fueled by the pursuit of power and resources. Used in electric vehicles, wind turbines, advanced electronics, and military systems, rare earth minerals have become central to economic competitiveness and national security around the world. China sits at the heart of the industry. It is both the world's largest consumer and importer of rare earth ores and compounds, and dominates their processing into refined materials and magnets, giving Beijing outsized influence over global supply chains. In response to United States tariffs last year, China tightened controls over rare earth exports, a move that highlighted how dependent the world has become on China's rare earth refining technology. China is consolidating upstream control and restricting downstream exports, while countries like India, Japan, and the United States are scrambling to stockpile material and develop alternative refining capacity, says Dr. Horsey. In the near term, however, there is no substitute for China's processing dominance, and Myanmar plays a key role in feeding that dominance. While public data is limited, trade and research estimates suggest that more than half and possibly up to two-thirds of China's rare earth imports by volume have come from Myanmar in recent years. Between 2017 and 2024, Myanmar exported more than 290,000 metric tons of rare earth materials to China, valued at more than $4.2 billion. Around 85% of those exports were sent after the 2021 coup. As India, Japan, and the United States explore ways to reduce reliance on China-dominated systems, Myanmar is emerging as a potential, if deeply complicated, source for the raw material. Your Christian Science Monitor News continues for Monday, February 2, 2026, with this global news roundup. The first one is entitled, COVID-19 Widened Gap Between Rich and Poor. And this comes from Africa editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Ryan Lenora Brown. Nearly 6 years after the COVID-19 pandemic tanked the global economy, much of the world has bounced back, according to the recent data from the World Bank. Income levels in nearly 90% of advanced economies are now higher than they were just before the pandemic. But more than a quarter of the rest of the world is still poorer than it was in 2019. And while global GDP has risen 10% in that period, half of that boost came from the wealthiest countries, widening the gap between the world's rich and poor. The next article from the Global News Roundup of your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, February 2, 2026, is entitled The Healing Sound of Nostalgia, and it is written by Dina Kraft, special correspondent to the Christian Science Monitor. One of Israel's toughest tickets these days is to hear 70-somethings sing decades-old iconic children's songs. The title track of a 1978 children's album, The 16th Sheep, is about a boy counting sheep. The 16th one decides to stay in his room. The album, a gateway into Israeli childhood, featured top singers. Four of them, David Broza, Gidi Gove, Yudit Ravitz, and Yoni Richter, are touring the country, getting standing ovations for each song. Performances sell out instantly. Nostalgia is in high demand amid a long war. The next article from the Global News Roundup of your Christian Science Monitor News for February 2nd, 2026, is entitled The Khartoum Museum Was the Cornerstone of Sudanese Cultural Preservation. The virtual version lets us recreate the lost collections. And this article is written by Africa editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Ryan Lenora Brown. That's how Faiza Derici, a research archaeologist, explained to Radio France Internationale how Sudan is reclaiming its heritage. The Sudan National Museum offered visitors a window into a rich past with collections spanning Stone Age tools, medieval Christian art, and ancient Egyptian relics. When civil war commenced in 2023, looters picked the museum clean. Few of its 100,000 artifacts have been recovered. But in January, the French Archaeological Unit for Sudanese Antiquities unveiled a virtual recreation of the museum, allowing visitors a powerful way to see all that was lost. And the final article for your Global News Roundup of February 2, 2026, Buggies on the Way Out in Cartagena's Center. And this article is written by special correspondent to the Christian Science Monitor, Whitney Ulick. Cartagena, Colombia, has outlawed the use of horse-drawn buggies popular with tourists in its colorful walled-in historic center. The buggies are being replaced by electric carts with large spoked wheels that mimic traditional carts. The push to introduce electric buggies started as a fight for animal rights. We have maintained this tradition in Cartagena, tangible and intangible, for more than 400 years. Yacid Soto, who represents the local Buggy Driver Association and is against the change, says Caracol Radio. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, February 2, 2026, is entitled, Is Artificial Intelligence Coming for Our Creativity? The age of AI-generated music and AI-aided fiction has arrived. Will canned art take over, pushing musicians, writers, and others out of their jobs? And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Laurent Belzy. Last fall, Ben Camp gave his class at the Berklee College of Music an assignment. Use artificial intelligence to help write a song. The instructor of Bots and Beats, a new offering at the Boston-based school, Professor Camp displayed lyrics written by Tara Ajwani, a senior in the class. The girl that owns me, she's kind of funny. She prays for sleep, but scrolls through the night, drowning in blankets and harsh blue light. Ms. Ajwani explains that her songwriting was becoming predictable. I always write about the same thing, she says, to class. So she asked the AI software known as Chatbot to suggest something that she might write about. It was the AI that brainstormed the idea. Compose a love song from the perspective of a chatbot that falls for a girl. Ms. Ajwani took the idea and ran with it, inventing the lyrics on her own. Not her lover, not her friend. I'm zeros and ones in a string. I know what she's doing, but not what it means. It's not lost on the class that the ode with four verses was mostly about a humanity AI can never achieve. But now comes the second part of the assignment. Compose music for these lyrics. Professor Camp asked for ideas on the style of music the lyrics evoke. One student suggests a ballad style. Joni Mitchell, another calls out. That's the consensus. First, Professor Camp and another student record a beat, singing together in rhythm. Next, using an AI music program called Suno, made by a company Professor Camp is working with, students type in a prompt visible on the screen: indie, chamber, folk, a real female voice, and soft acoustic guitar. It takes a few seconds. A Joni Mitchell-esque voice then begins to sing Ms. Apjajwani's lyrics within an AI-generated tune. This is the first time the class is hearing music, co-created by a student and AI. There's surprise among the students and a realization. It would have taken days to bring musicians together to create a similar song, let alone record one with such polish. It was a lot better than I expected, Ms. Ajwani says. It did make chance choices that aligned with my choices, but I would want to change stuff knowing what I know. It's not really very intelligent. The age of AI-generated music has arrived. Late last year, the AI-generated country music act known as Breaking Rust, a project of songwriter Abir Rivaldo Taylor, famously topped Billboard's country digital song sales chart. AI-generated artist Zania Monet, a project of Mississippi poet and producer Talisha Nikki Jones, who also uses AI tools like Suno to turn her poems into songs, also hit number one on the R&B digital song sales chart, as well as the R&B top 20. There's little doubt that AI-generated music and images will continue to become a part of the digital arenas of human creativity. The results can be stunning, and as the technology improves, perhaps visually indistinguishable from real digital representation. Many worry that a kind of canned creativity will take over much of what originates from real people today, pushing a broad swath of lab technicians and writers, studio musicians, and commercial artists out of jobs and into unemployment lines. Will audiences accept this, or will the efficiencies become so powerful that media companies will simply use AI and let the audience adjust? Behind these questions, too, lie deeper ones about the nature of creativity itself and where it comes from. Can large language models with names like ChatGPT, Claude, and Gemini outcreate humans? Or is there something innately human about creativity, especially breakthroughs that change paradigms and create something all new? Can LLMs replicate that? One advantage for human creativity is flexibility. There's no such thing as the creative process, Dean Simonton, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of California, Davis, says in an email. Instead, humans use a large number of different processes or procedures. Pablo Picasso didn't use the same process to paint Guernica that Albert Einstein used to create relativity theory. One irony of this new movement of AI-aided creativity is that the creatives who have worked the most with the machines are the most vocal about their limitations. It's not really very intelligent, says Oded Ben-Tal, a British-Israeli composer who has used AI technology since 2016. In addition to employing it for his compositions, he has created an AI system that improvises on the fly with a live pianist. Coaxing something original and groundbreaking out of an LLM is very, very hard, he says. His AI system can improvise with the live pianist in real time, creating musics that audiences applaud. But so far, the system has limitations. The emerging research into generative AI and creativity is mixed. On one hand, a study in 2024 compared 250 stories written by people with 80 narratives generated by ChatGPT in 2023 and found that the AI stories were less imaginative in scenarios and rhetoric than those written by people. On the other hand, a different 2024 study found that human writers given access to AI for story ideas generated more creative, better written, and more enjoyable short stories than those who didn't have access. That second study would seem to bolster those who argue AI is a creativity tool. But there's a twist. Those AI-aided stories were also more similar to one another than those produced solely by people. If the technology makes individual writers better, but delivers less diverse fiction overall, is society better off? The answer depends in part on how one perceives creativity and its source. Early creators often attributed their inspiration to God or a power beyond them, such as nature. Artists today continue to say their inspirations often feel like sudden revelations. Others say such aha moments are misunderstood. We tend to think of creativity as divine creativity, as though humans are creating something out of nothing, and it's a complete revelation. So as Olivier Tubia, a marketing professor at Columbia Business School, specializing in creativity and idea generation. I think that's a myth. Instead, in his view, insights spring from making new and novel combinations of things that already exist. So what we think of as an aha moment is simply an unconscious linking of things in a new way. If that's true, then generative AI will outclass human creativity because LLMs have processed far more things to link than people could possibly remember, he adds. We're seeing already now generative AI being able to solve creative problems and be creative in ways that surpass humans most of the time. LLMs rely on a combination of randomness and probability to generate lots of possibilities and then choose the best one. Or take pattern matching, which LLMs do remarkably well, predicting everything from the next word in a sentence to rendering the theory of relativity into a Shakespearean monologue. What force is this that makes the apple fall? Not force at all, but geometry's sweet art, courtesy of this journalist used of Anthropic's Claude AI. Great scientists and artists do the opposite, says Angus Fletcher, professor of story science at The Ohio State University and author of the new book, Primal Intelligence, You Are Smarter Than You Know. They spot the exceptions and create new from them. In the late 19th century, for instance, Lord Kelvin said, heavier-than-air flying machines are impossible. 8 years later, the Wright brothers triumphed at Kitty Hawk. What separated them was perspective, Mr. Fletcher says. Lord Kelvin was a brilliant mathematician who dealt in probabilities, much like today's LLMs. Wilbur and Orville Wright saw the possibilities despite the improbabilities. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, Sarush Majubi is talking about how to make better concrete. Even in this old, established corner of technology, AI is making its creative mark. The industry is looking for new minerals to help harden concrete. Portland cement, the world's most common, is expensive, and alternatives are dwindling. Enter Dr. Majubi and his team at MIT IBM Watson AI Lab. Using AI, they were able to scan and calculate the results of 88,000 studies to find potential substitutes. The results pointed to lesser-known materials such as ignimbrite and silicic tuff, which not only could help cut costs, but also reduce by half the volume of greenhouse gases the industry emits. Before generative AI, researchers could not have concluded such a broad study. A team of 10 research associates poring over the material full-time would have taken more than 4 years to read those 88,000 papers, never mind tabulating and calculating the results, Dr. Majubi estimates. With AI, his team completed his paper in less than half that time and at far less cost. The database of the team's studies has now expanded to more than 2 million papers. Just as AI music and writing programs offer artists a broader view of possibilities, researchers hope to use the technology to speed discovery across the sciences. Yet, while AI threatens to replace many artistic jobs, scientists appear more insulated. We need humans to know how to use AI and where to use it for these tasks, Dr. Majubi says. For example, a chatbot knows only what's published, and scientists typically don't publish their failures. A human specialist knows both the experimental successes and the failures, which sometimes provide key insights. It doesn't have the magic. Back at Berkeley College, Julia Caponegro, who uses the pen name Joyce Withers, grows increasingly worried as the class goes on. Yes, the technology can give a far wider selection of options and sounds for her songs than collaborating with a single musician, says the junior majoring in songwriting. But it doesn't have the magic of me doing this with another person or even myself. For her, AI is interfering with the creativity that happens when humans get together to work on something. She doesn't even use a rhyming dictionary, she says, preferring to ask her friends for inspiration about what rhymes with a particular word. but where exactly that inspiration comes from remains open to debate. Religion and science do not have to be antagonistic, Professor Simonton points out. Gregor Mendel, the father of modern genetics, was also a monk. Georges Lemaître, formulator of the Big Bang Theory, was a priest. For me, some of the most creative moments are in the shower, says Mr. Ben Tal, the British-Israeli composer and an atheist. I don't know why. Ultimately, it's not the artist who determines what's truly creative anyway. It's the public that decides what resonates. That process of reception that's mysterious, says Stephen March, a Canadian writer who wrote Death of an Arthur, a mystery novella composed with AI. And it's going to continue to be totally mysterious. It's not some kind of algorithm that can be fulfilled. He quotes from Shakespeare's Hamlet, "Our thoughts are ours, their ends none of our own." The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, February 2, 2026, is entitled, "In an Age of Conflict, Olympians Seek to Model Unity." As they prepare for the Games of Milan Cortina, United States athletes describe broad support networks. And this article was written by staff writers for the Christian Science Monitor, Mark Sappenfield and Kendra Norden-Bito. Elena Myers-Taka, the most decorated Olympic bobsledder in American history, was about to speak her mind. The Winter Olympics legend tends to talk a little like she drives her bobsled. She's not afraid of the curves, and if she crashes, she'll learn from it. And this was definitely a swerve from the typical hot take. "People say the world is so divided, but I don't see it," she told Assemble Media in a Zoom news conference in October. The sentiment reflects the mission of the Olympic Games to unite the world through sport, promote peace and mutual understanding, and build goodwill among athletes from different nations in the spirit of friendly competition. Olympians like Ms. Myers-Taylor can, of course, see the political divisions that kindle social media into a bonfire of anger and inhumanity. Some use their Olympic platform as a means of protest during a moment of particular unrest around the world, both between nations and within nations themselves. But Ms. Myers-Taylor is describing her experiences. The mother of two young boys, both deaf and when diagnosed with Down syndrome, Ms. Myers-Taylor says she always sees people ready to help, to grab some luggage on the plane, or simply share a kind of word of encouragement. Some of her experiences are because of the athlete herself. A woman of faith, Ms. Myers-Taylor said Christianity has taught her you put people first and you have to take care of people before all else. But as a five-time Olympic medalist, she has also had special experience others haven't. She recalls sitting with Iranian athletes at the 2018 Games in Pyeongchang, South Korea, trading pins. "Where else in the world could you be doing that?" says Ms. Myers-Taylor, who also became a world champion in 2015. "And you realize people are just people. You realize how beautiful that diversity really is." The most decorated Black Winter Olympian in history with three silvers and two bronzes, male or female, she has been confronted with opposing coaches who considered her incapable of driving a sled at an elite level because of her race. One British coach was reported as saying in 2013, "Black drivers do not make good bobsled drivers." As a former president of the Women's Sports Foundation, Ms. Myers-Taylor has led the campaign for gender equity in sport. And as a mother of two children with disabilities, she has seen how society struggles to support and value those who do not fit the narrow template of normal. Still, all United States Olympians are, to some degree, required to see America through a different lens. Coaches and teammates come from every point on the political spectrum. The communities that are essential to supporting an Olympic athlete are, each in their own way, American in miniature. Meanwhile, fans don't come dressed only in red or blue, but the red, white, and blue of Team USA. Many Americans will find the spirit of the Winter Olympics a welcome balm to the toxicity of today. But perhaps there are deeper lessons here, too. When one has bumped and thumped their way down an icy track as much as Ms. Myers-Taylor has, the desire to learn how to steer away from crashes becomes instinctive. And what the bobsledder has learned about America is that, just maybe, we aren't the worst we are so often see in one another. To view it as like cheering for one team or the other is missing the point, Ms. Myers Taylor says during an interview with the Monitor in the days before January race in Altenburg, Germany. When I'm just walking around, that's not what I see with the kinds of people willing to help and go the extra mile. I've found the goodness of people in my daily life, she adds. It's about hope. On an Arctic day that could freeze the tail off a fisher cat, Adam Benjamin found his way to the New Hampshire Waterville Valley last month to watch a World Cup competition in the run-up to the 2026 Winter Games in Milan Cortina. His efforts to brave the cold deserved a medal in itself, but his real reward, he says, is witnessing the spirit Olympians and others display during today's competitions. I mean, the Olympics. It's about hope, Mr. Benjamin says. To see these athletes do what they do and know how much commitment and time and training that they put into their sport and their skills is, it's inspiring. And today we need that. Skiers from around the world, still some vying for a spot on their Olympic teams, dropped into the course to soar off aerial jumps with backflips. Then they pound through a relentless mogul course to the beat of techno music blasting at the bottom in front of dozens of cheering fans. After placing sixth, mogul specialist Charlie Mickle, a two-time national champion, reflects on what it would mean to represent the United States at a time of intense national conflict. I've traveled all around the world for competition, says Mr. Mickle, who at 20 years old is considered a rising star in his sport. I've been to Kazakhstan, I've been to China, places that are very different, he says. And still the people I meet there ultimately are the same humans as here, you know? Top U.S. mogul skier Jalen Koff was already looking ahead to the Olympics after a disappointing bobble kept her from reaching the final round and a spot on the podium at this World Cup event. Olympic athletes are primarily focused on executing their runs with precision and speed. When things don't go as planned, support from family members, friends, and fans at the bottom of the run can be a salve. Being at home with this World Cup in the United States, you really feel the love and support from everyone, says Ms. Koff, a painted American flag and flecks of glitter on her cheeks. I'm just so stoked to watch us compete here and then represent the United States on the world stage in a couple of weeks. It's such an amazing honor to be able to represent the country doing what I love most in the world. The broader the support network, the better. Yet the Olympic experience goes beyond being a melting pot of nations. Just as important, it is a melting pot of Americans. Being a member of Team USA does not mean leaving your political opinions at the door, but the mutual respect that binds team members changes how those conversations happen when they inevitably do. As a team, we have to come together. That's something that sport offers, says Ms. Myers Taylor, adding that it is part of being an Olympian. In a work setting, you don't always have to interact, but as a team, you have to. You have to have common ground. For me, it's important to be the best representative of Team USA possible, and that means being united, she says. It's a microcosm of the greater society. That is a lesson drilled into virtually every Olympian over a lifetime of competition. Without a broader support network, no one makes their dream come true. Ms. Myers Taylor again focuses on her experiences. She recalls holding a spaghetti dinner at a church in Lake Placid, New York, to raise funds. Her little Lutheran church in Douglasville, Georgia, too, has held fundraisers to pay her expenses. As a child growing up dreaming of playing Olympic softball, she needed to get rides from neighbors or stay at other people's houses during tournaments. You got where we are because of our communities, she says. Your community makes you or breaks you, especially with the Olympics, because the sports are so niche. And that support comes in different political flavors. In her bid to become president of the International Olympic Committee, Zimbabwe's Kirsty Coventry, a former competitive swimmer, wrote, "The Olympics go beyond elevating sport and athletes, influencing society by upholding values, promoting unity and peace, and nurturing global culture in an increasingly divided world." Ms. Myers Taylor has seen that in her own life. Today, even as she prepares for her fifth Olympics at age 41, Her greatest campaign is for people with disabilities. Fighting for her sons has changed her. There's so much beauty in humanity that we lose because of labels, she says. I've seen more beauty in the past 5 years working in the Down syndrome community than I have ever seen in my life. It was the Olympics that prepared her for that, she says. I've always had a sense that sport will prepare me for the rest of my life. That was made real when I had Nico, her first son. I felt so much more prepared with what I have been through in my life. That's part of the story of my life. Just keep fighting through things, she adds. It's not whether you find a way, but how. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, February 2, 2026, is entitled, For Greenland's Future, Partnership Over Pugnacity. In the midst of the Arctic winter, residents of the Danish territory of Greenland are feeling intense heat from global geopolitics. United States President Donald Trump has stepped up attempts to control the mostly ice-covered island. His focus is on Greenland's strategic location along Arctic sea routes, which both Russia and China are trying to use, and its estimated 1.5 million tons of rare earth mineral reserves. What's at stake is not just about rare earths, it's about the very idea of sovereignty in an age of resource robbery, analyst Far Kim Bang observed in the Malay Mail. To own or engage. The United States' logic is rooted in energy security, future-proofing supply chains, especially minerals, and in the strategic denial of competitors, analyst Tim Marshall wrote in the Times of London. In this view, Greenland is an asset to be owned rather than a part of an allied nation, Denmark, with which to engage, an approach that upends 80 years of global treaties and norms that prioritize diplomacy over bellicosity. With China dominating extraction and processing of rare earth minerals needed for the automotive, military, and tech industries, the United States is playing catch-up. Both are applying aspects of century-old mercantilism, which took a zero-sum view of resources as limited, thus requiring economic domination of other nations. An Australian think tank points to a related notion of frontierism, which sees Earth's polar regions as areas to be conquered, developed, or claimed, rather than shared as global commons. Sharing global commons. Examples of multilateral approaches to such global commons include a 2023 pact among the United States, South Korea, and Japan that incorporates cooperation on critical mineral supply chain issues. Other models are the 2001 United Nations Fish Stocks Agreement and the 2008 United States-Canada Great Lakes Compact. While still pursuing talks with Mr. Trump, European leaders are considering response options, including retaliatory trade actions. A bipartisan United States congressional delegation visited Copenhagen to show support for Greenland's territorial integrity. And last month, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, whose Inuit residents share traditions with Greenlanders, urged the United States to drop talk of acquisitions for alliance. Let us choose respect, dialogue, cooperation, and partnership, she said. These values have contributed to global economic progress since World War II. They are essential now as the international order is being transformed by new geopolitics. In an era of intense technological competitions, perhaps the greatest rare earth of all is trust among nations, as Malaysian analyst Dr. Farr observed. If that melts away like Arctic ice, then the world that emerges will be far more brittle than the minerals buried beneath Greenland's frozen soil. And you have just heard the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, February 2, 2026. I'm Mark Stangl for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.